Part 2, 1977. The Land Rover turned off the blacktop road, and as soon as it hit the dirt track, the pale dust boiled out from under its back wheels. It was an elderly vehicle. The desert-coloured paintwork was scored and scratched by thorn and branch down to the bare metal. Rock and sharp shale had bitten chunks of rubber out of the heavily lugged tyres. The doors in the top were off, and the cracked windshield lay flat on the bonnet, so that the wind swept over the two men in the front seat. Behind their heads stood the gun rack. The forks, lined with foam rubber, held a formidable battery of weapons. Two semi-automatic FN rifles, sprayed with dun and green camouflage paint, a short 9mm Uzi submachine gun, with the extra-long magazine clipped on, ready for instant use. And, still in its canvas slipcover, a heavy Colt Sauer Grand African, whose .458 Magnum cartridge could knock a bull elephant off its feet. From the uprights of the gun rack dangled haversacks containing the spare clips and magazines, and a damp canvas water bottle. They swung harmoniously with each jolt and lurch of the Land Rover. Craig Mello drove with his foot jamming the accelerator to the floorboards. Though the vehicle's body clattered and banged loosely, he had always serviced and tuned the engine himself, and the speedometer needle pressed against the top pin at the end of the dial. There is only one way to go into an ambush, and that is flat out. Get through it as fast as possible, remembering always that they usually laid it out at least half a kilometre deep. Even at 150 k's an hour, that meant receiving fire for 12 seconds. In that time, a good man with an AK-47 can get off three magazines of 30 rounds each. Yes, the way to go in was fast. But of course a landmine was a beast of an entirely different colour. When they boosted one of those sweethearts with 10 kilos of plastic, it kicked you and your vehicle 50 feet high in the air and shot your spine out through the top of your skull. So although Craig lounged comfortably on the hard leather seat, his eyes scoured the road ahead. This late in the day, there had been traffic through ahead of him, and he drove for the diamond tracks in the dust. But he watched for an extraneous tuft of grass, an old cigarette packet, or even a pat of dried cow dung that could conceal the marks of a dig in the road. Of course, this close to Bulawayo, he was in more danger from a drunken driver than from terrorist activity, but it was wise to nurture the habit. Craig glanced sideways at his passenger and jerked his thumb over his shoulder. The man swiveled in his seat and reached into the cool box in the back. He brought out two cans of Lion beer with the dew on them, and while he did so, Craig flicked his attention back to the road. Craig Mello was 29 years old, although the floppy thatch of dark hair blowing all over his forehead, the innocent candour of his hazel eyes, and the vulnerable slant to his wide, gentle mouth gave him the air of a small boy who expects to be unjustly reprimanded at any moment. He still wore the embroidered green shoulder flashes of a ranger in the Department of Wildlife and Nature Conservation on his khaki bush shirt. Beside him, Samson Kumalo pulled the tabs off the beer cans. He wore the same uniform. But he was a tall Matabele, with a deep, intelligent forehead and a hard, smooth-shaven lantern jaw. He ducked as a spurt of froth flew from the cans, and then handed one of them to Craig and kept one for himself. Craig saluted him with his can and swigged a mouthful, then licked the white moustache from his upper lip and put the Land Rover to the twisting road up the Kami Hills. Before they reached the crest, Craig dropped the empty can into the plastic trash bag that hung from the dash and slowed the Land Rover, looking for the turnoff. Tall yellow grass hid the small faded sign, which said, "Kami Anglican Mission, Staff Cottages, No Through Road." It was at least a year since Craig had last driven this road, and he almost missed it. "Here it is," Samson warned him, and he swung sharply onto the secondary track. It jinked through the forest, then came abruptly to the long straight avenue of spathodia trees that led down to the staff village. The trunks were thicker than a man's chest, and the dark green branches met overhead. At the head of the avenue, almost screened by the trees and the long grass, was a low, whitewashed wall with a rusty, wrought-iron gate. Craig pulled onto the verge and switched off the engine. "Why are we stopping here?" Samson asked. They always spoke English when they were alone, just as they always spoke Cinderbelly when anyone else was listening, just as Samson called him Craig in private and Nkosi or Mambo at all other times. It was a tacit understanding between them, for in this tortured, war-torn land, there were those who had taken Samson's fluent English as the mark of a so-called cheeky mission boy, and recognized by the easy intimacy between the two men that Craig was that thing of doubtful loyalties, a Kaffir lover. The word Kaffir is derived from the Arabic word for an infidel. During the 19th century, it denoted members of the Southern African tribes. Without any derogatory bias, it was employed by statesmen, eminent authors, missionaries and champions of the native peoples. Nowadays, its use is the sure mark of the racial bigot. "Why are we stopping at the old cemetery?" Samson repeated. "All that beer." Craig climbed out of the Land Rover and stretched. "I have to pump ship." He relieved himself against the battered front wheel, then went to sit on the low wall of the graveyard, swinging his long, bare, sun-browned legs. He wore khaki shorts and suede desert boots without socks, for the barbed seeds of arrow grass stick into knitted wool. Craig looked down onto the roofs of the Kami mission station that lay below the wooded hills. Some of the older buildings, dating back to before the turn of the century, were thatched, although the new school and hospital were tiled with red terracotta. However, the rows of low-cost housing in the compound were covered with unpainted corrugated asbestos. They made an unsightly grey huddle beside the lovely green of the irrigated fields. They offended Craig's aesthetic sense, and he looked away.
"Come on, Sam, let's get cracking."
Craig broke off and frowned.
"What the hell are you doing?"
Samson had gone through the wrought-iron gate into the walled cemetery and was urinating casually onto one of the gravestones.
"Jesus, Sam, man, that's desecration."
"An old family custom." Samson shook himself and zipped up. "My grandpa Gideon taught it to me," he explained, and then switched into Cinderbelly. "Giving water to make the flower grow again," he said.
"Oh, what the hell's that supposed to mean?"
"The man that lies down there killed a Matabili girl called Imbali, the flower," said Samson. "My grandfather always pees on his grave whenever he passes this way." Craig's shock was gradually replaced by curiosity. He swung his legs over the wall and went to stand by Samson.
"Sacred to the memory of General Mungo St. John, killed during the Matabili Rebellion of 1896.
Craig read the inscription aloud.
"Man hath no greater love than this, that he lay down his life for another. Intrepid sailor, brave soldier, faithful husband and devoted father. Always remembered by his widow, Robin, and his son, Robert."
Craig combed the hair out of his eyes with his fingers.
"Judging by his advertising, he was one hell of a guy.
He was a bloody murderer. He, as much as any one man could, provoked the rebellion."
"Is that so?"
Craig passed on to the next grave and read that inscription.
"Here lie the mortal remains of Dr. Robin St. John, nay Ballantyne, founder of Kami Mission, departed this life April 16, 1931, aged 94 years. Well done, thou good and faithful servant."
He glanced back at Samson.
"Do you know who she was?"
"My grandfather calls her Nomuza, the girl child of mercy. She was one of the most beautiful people who ever lived."
"I never heard of her either."
"You should have. She was your great-great-grandmother."
"Oh, I've never bothered much with a family history. Mother and father were second cousins, that's all I know. Mellows and Ballantynes for generations back. I've never sorted them all out."
"A man without a past is a man without a future," Samson quoted.
"You know, Sam, sometimes you get up my nose." Craig grinned at him. "You've got an answer for everything."
He walked on down the row of old graves, some of them with elaborate headstones, doves and groups of mourning angels, and they were decked with faded artificial flowers in domes of clear glass. Others were covered with simple concrete slabs, in which the lettering had eroded to the point of illegibility. Craig read those that he could. Robert St. John, aged 54 years, son of Mungo and Robin. Juba Kumalo, aged 83 years, Fly Little Dove. And then he stopped as he saw his own surname. Victoria Mello, née Codrington. Died 8th of April 1936, aged 63 years. Daughter of Clinton and Robin, wife of Harold. Hey, Sam, if you were right about the others, then this must have been my great-grandmother. There was a tuft of grass growing out of the crack through the slab, and Craig stooped and plucked it out. And as he did so, he felt a bond of affinity with the dust beneath that stone. It had laughed and loved and given birth that he might live. "Hi there, Gran," he whispered. "I wonder what you were really like." "Craig, it's almost 1 o'clock," Sam interrupted him. "Okay, I'm coming." But Craig lingered a few moments longer, held by that unaccustomed nostalgia. "I'll ask Bawu," he decided, and went back to the Land Rover. He stopped again outside the first cottage of the village. The small yard was freshly raked, and there were petunias in tubs on the veranda. "Look here, Sam," Craig began awkwardly. "I don't know what you're going to do now. You could join the police, like I'm doing. Perhaps we could work it that we were together again." "Perhaps," Sam agreed expressionlessly. "Or I could talk to Bawu about getting you a job at King's Lynn."
"Clerk at the pay office, you mean?" Sam asked.
"Yeah, I know," Craig scratched his ear.
"Still, it's something."
"I will think about it," Sam murmured.
"Hell, I feel bad. But you didn't have to come with me, you know. You could have stayed in the department."
"Not after what they did to you." Sam shook his head.
"Oh, thanks, Sam."
They sat silently for a while, then Sam climbed down and lugged his bag out of the back of the Land Rover.
"I'll come out and see you as soon as I'm fixed up. We'll work something out," Craig promised. "Keep in touch, Sam."
"Sure," Sam held out his hand, and they shook briefly.
"Hambagashli, go in peace," Sam said.
"Salagashli, stay in peace," Craig answered.
Craig started the Land Rover and swung back the way they had come. As he drove up the avenue of Spithodia, he glanced in the rearview mirror. Sam was standing in the centre of the road with his bag on one shoulder, watching him go. There was a hollow feeling of bereavement in Craig's chest. The two of them have been together for so long.
"I'll work it out somehow," he repeated determinedly.
Craig slowed at the top of the rise, as he always did here, anticipating his first glimpse of the homestead. But when it came, it was with that little shock of disappointment. Bawu had stripped the thatch off the roof and replaced it with dull grey corrugated asbestos sheeting. It had to be done, of course. An RPG-7 rocket fired into the thatch from outside the perimeter, and the whole building would have gone up like the 5th of November. Still, Craig resented the change, just as he did the loss of the beautiful jacaranda trees. They had been planted by Bawu's grandfather, old Zuga Ballantyne, who had built King's Lynn back in the early 1890s. In spring their gentle rain of blue petals had carpeted the lawns. But they had been cut down to open a field of defensive fire around the house, and in their place now stood the 10-foot security fence of diamond mesh and barbed wire. Craig drove down into the shallow dip below the main homestead, towards the complex of offices, storerooms, and tractor workshops, which were the heart of the vast, sprawling ranch. Before he was halfway down, a lanky figure appeared in the high doorway of the workshop and stood with arms akimbo, watching him approach.
"Hello, Grandpa."
Craig climbed out of the Land Rover, and the old man frowned to cover his pleasure.
"How many times have I got to tell you, don't call me that? You want people to think I'm old?"
Jonathan Ballantyne was burned and desiccated by the sun to the consistency of biltong, the dark strips of dried venison that were such a Rhodesian delicacy. It seemed that if you were to cut him, dust and not blood would pour from the wound.
but his eyes were still a brilliant twinkling green, and his hair was a dense white shock that fell to his collar at the back of his neck. It was one of his many conceits. He shampooed it every day, and brushed it with a pair of silver-backed brushes that stood on the table beside his bed. "Sorry, Barwoo," Craig reverted to his Matabele name, the gadfly, and seized the old man's hand. It was mere bone covered by cool, dry skin, but the grip was startlingly strong.
"So you got yourself fired again," Jonathan accused. Although his teeth were artificial, they were a neat fit, filling out the wizened cheeks,
and he kept them so sparkling white as to match his hair and silvery moustache. Another of his conceits.
"I resigned," Craig denied. "You got fired?"
"It was close," Craig admitted. "But I beat them to it. I resigned."
Craig was not really surprised that Jonathan already knew of his latest misfortune. Nobody knew how old Jonathan Ballantyne was for certain. The outside estimate was 100 years, though 80-plus was Craig's guess. But still nothing got by him.
"You can give me a lift up to the house,"
Jonathan swung up easily onto the high passenger seat, and with relish began pointing out the additions to the defence of the homestead.
"I have put in 20 more claymores on the front lawn."
Jonathan's claymore mines were 10 kilos of plastic explosive, packed inside a drum of scrap iron suspended on a pipe tripod. He could fire them electrically from his bedroom. Jonathan was a chronic insomniac, and Craig had a bizarre mental picture of the old man, spending every night sitting bolt upright in his nightshirt, with his finger on the button, praying for a terrorist to come within range. The war had added 20 years to his life. Jonathan hadn't had such a good time since the First Battle of the Somme, where he had won his MC one lovely autumn morning by grenading 3 German machine-gun nests in quick succession. Secretly, Craig believed that the first thing any Zimbabwe People's Revolutionary Army guerrilla recruit was taught when he began his basic training was to give King's Lynn and the crazy old man who lived there the widest possible berth. As they drove up through the gates in the security fence and were surrounded by a mixed pack of fearsome Rottweilers and Doberman Pinschers, Jonathan explained the latest refinements to his battle plan.
"If they come from behind the kopje, I'll let them get into the minefield, then take them in enfilade."
He was still explaining and gesticulating as they climbed the steps to the wide veranda, and he finished the briefing by adding darkly and mysteriously,
"I have just invented a secret weapon. I'm going to test it tomorrow morning. You can watch."
"But I'd enjoy that, Barwoo,"
Craig thanked him doubtfully. The last tests that Jonathan had conducted had blown all the windows out of the kitchens and flesh-wounded the Matabele cook. Craig followed Jonathan down the wide, shady veranda. The wall was hung with hunting trophies, the horns of buffalo and kudu and eland, and on each side of the double-glass doors leading to the old dining room, now the library, stood a pair of enormous elephant tusks, so long and curved that their tips almost met at the level of the ceiling above the doorway. As he went through the door, Jonathan absent-mindedly stroked one of them. There was a spot on the thick yellow curve that had been polished shining by the touch of his fingers over the decades.
"Pour us a gin each, my boy," he ordered.
Jonathan had stopped drinking whiskey on the day that Harold Wilson's government had imposed sanctions on Rhodesia. It was Jonathan's single-handed retaliatory attempt at disrupting the economy of the British Isles.
"By God, you've drowned it," he complained, as he tasted the concoction,
and dutifully Craig took his glass back to the Amboya cocktail cabinet and stiffened the gin component.
"Ah, yeah, that's a little better."
Jonathan settled himself behind his desk and placed the Stuart crystal tumbler in the centre of his leather and brass-bound blotter.
"Now," he said, "tell me what happened this time."
And he fixed Craig with those bright green eyes.
"Well, Bao, it's a long story. I don't want to bore you."
Craig sank down into the deep leather armchair and became intensely interested in the furnishings of the room, which he had known since childhood. He read the titles on the spines of the Morocco-bound books on the shelves and studied the massed display of blue silk rosettes, which the prize Afrikaner bulls of King's Lynn had won at every agricultural show south of the Zambezi River.
"Shall I tell you what I heard?" I heard you refused to obey the legitimate order of your superior, to wit, the head game warden, and that thereafter you perpetrated a violence upon that worthy, or more specifically, that you punched him in the head, giving him the excuse to dismiss you, for which he had probably been searching desperately since the first day you arrived in the park.
The reports are exaggerated.
Don't give me that little boy grin of yours, young man. This is not a matter of levity, Jonathan told him sternly. Did you refuse to partake in the elephant cull, or did you not?
Have you ever been on a cull, John John? Craig asked softly.
He only used his grandfather's pet name in moments of deep sincerity.
The spotter plane picks up a likely herd, say 50 animals, and radio talks us onto them. We go in the last mile or so on foot at a dead run. We get in very close, 10 paces, so we're shooting uphill. We use the 4.58s to cannon them. What we do is pick out the old queens of the herd, because the younger animals love and respect them so much that they won't leave them. We hit the queens first, headshots, of course. That gives us plenty of time to work on the others. We're pretty good at it by now. We drop them so fast that the heaps have to be pulled apart by tractors afterwards. And that leaves the calves. It's interesting to watch a calf trying to lift its dead mother back onto her feet again with its tiny trunk.
It has to be done, Craig, said Jonathan quietly. The parks are overstocked by thousands of animals.
But Craig seemed not to have heard.
If the orphan calves are too young to survive, we hit them also. But if they're the right age, we round them up and sell them to a nice old man who takes them away and resells them to a zoo in Tokyo or Amsterdam, where they will stand behind bars with a chain around the foot and eat the peanuts that the tourists throw them.
It has to be done, Jonathan repeated.